but at least we'll have some privacy here.
Hey there, and welcome back to Marvel by the Month. My name's Brian Stratton.
And mine is Rob Milne.
And this week we're going to be talking about all the Marvel comics that came out with the cover date of December 1963. This is a slimmer month than last month, thank God, because that... Man, I mean, okay, I'm complaining about having to read 9 Marvel comics last week. That's not exactly a fate worse than death.
Right, and we even had, you know, no Ant-Man, really.
Right, exactly, so, yeah. But
double bonus.
Yeah, but, I mean, Stan Lee wrote all 9 of those, and then Jack Kirby illustrated, like, 2/3 of them. So,
right.
Like, I don't know where I get off complaining. Yeah.
they're still... It still takes some time.
Yeah.
I'm trying to read, you know, all of the other comics too.
Right.
So, let alone the stack of actual graphic novels that are sitting there under books.
Yeah. No, I've got a, I believe I'm up to like a 3-foot stack of things I haven't read
that
yet.
Is...
And it's almost taller than my kid.
Yeah. Yeah. It's making my wife sad.
Yeah.
Sorry, Barb.
when I go to the gym, cause you know, I'm at that age where you have to actively try not to die. The only way I can motivate myself to like stay on an elliptical machine for half an hour to 45 minutes, is to, you got to have, you know, decent music in your headphones, but also, I just bring in comics with me.
I love that.
And I,
so geeky.
It's such a nerd thing to do. But, what I found is like, cause I'm also a really quick reader. So, you know, what I don't want to happen is to bring in something and then, you know, 28 minutes into my workout, be done with it. And like, well, what am I going to do now? So I've started bringing in the Marvel Epic collections, which is great. So, you know, I just read, you know, 150 pages of, you know, 1960s Thor comics.
Right.
And it's pretty great. So
you're really reading ahead now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can imagine you though, getting outside on a track and just having, you know, the comic book dangling literally on a stick in front of you.
It's the old carrot and stick, except replace carrot with comic book. Hopefully this will extend my life, so I have even longer to read all the comics that I've bought and haven't gotten around to reading yet. So,
yeah.
All right. What are we talking about this week? We've got a bunch of comics. We're going to be talking about Strange Tales, number 115, which has a battle between the Human Torch and the Sandman and the origin of Doctor Strange. Pretty cool.
Yeah.
We got Tales to Astonish, number 50, with Giant Man and the Wasp versus the Human Top. Less cool. Fantastic Four, number 21. Fantastic Four and Nick Fury versus the Hate Monger. We've got Amazing Spider-Man, number 7, with the Return of the Vulture. Journey into Mystery, number 99. First appearance of Mr. Hyde. And a cool backup story with Odin versus Surtur. And wrapping it all up, Tales of Suspense, number 48, with Iron Man versus the legendary Mr. Dahl.
Mr. Dahl is such a wrestler name.
Yeah. But before we get into all that, how about we talk a little bit about what was going on in October 1963 when these comics were on the stands?
Sure. Yeah. On the 2nd of October, we have the Kennedy administration announcing that all 15,000 of the troops currently deployed to Vietnam could be withdrawn by the end of 1965.
Well, that sounds pretty good.
It does. However, after Kennedy was assassinated, President Lyndon Johnson escalated the conflict instead. So not as good.
Yeah, not great. But talking of Vietnam, just 3 days later, on the advice of his national security team, President Kennedy opted to withhold further military aid to South Vietnam until President Ngo Dinh Diem implemented some political reforms. Did he implement them? Well,
on the 27th, in this same vein, Ambassador Henry Cabot Lodge received the green light telegram in Saigon, which authorized Lodge to signal that the United States would not oppose a coup against Ngo Dinh Diem. So I don't think he did.
Yeah, probably not. In other Cold War news, on the 10th of October, 1963, the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty officially went into effect, which is great. Not even a week later, on the 16th, the first 2 Vela satellites were launched into orbit to monitor for signs of violations of the Nuclear Test Ban Treaty.
That's pretty cool.
So that's awesome. So basically, threat of nuclear war is ended.
Sure. On the 26th of October, the Polaris A3 missile was successfully fired from the USS Andrew Jackson, a nuclear submarine.
Oh, no.
The missile, which could support a nuclear payload and had a range of 2,880 miles, meant that there was no longer anywhere on the surface of the Earth that was safe from nuclear detonation. So, wah, wah.
Yeah. But we're not going to test them anymore. I guess we're not going to test them anymore because we know they work.
Right.
And now we can hit anyone anywhere. We're just
going to drive around with them and threaten everybody.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Pretty much. Not great. Here is something that is great, though. A little bit of pop culture news. There's two things that happen on the 6th of October that I am pretty excited about. So first of all, Dick Dale and his Deltones performed on the Ed Sullivan Show, and that was the first time that surf rock had been played live on national television.
Oh, funny note.
Yeah.
I actually got to open for Dick Dale.
What?
At a show in Seattle once.
Are you kidding?
In the 90s.
That's amazing.
It was awesome. I was not old enough to go in. I had to wait in my van to go in and play, but I got to shake his hand.
That is wild.
Yep.
Did he still shred?
Oh, he shredded. Yeah, we looked like idiots opening for him. You know, we played our show and then we crawled back out to our van and stuck our head in the back door and listened to him play.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you did the primary job of an opening act is to not outshine the main event. So
no problem there.
Yeah, that's awesome. Very cool. Something that makes me almost as happy as that was the other thing that happened on the 6th of October, 1963, when Sandy Koufax and the Los Angeles Dodgers completed their 4-game sweep of the evil New York Yankees with a 2-1 win at Dodger Stadium.
Well, on the 21st, a little term that's near and dear to my heart, the term Beatlemania was used in print for the first time. That was in the headline of a Daily Mail feature story.
In less awesome news, you know, here's the part where we bum everyone out by talking about just the crappy state of civil rights and race relations in America. But you got to take your medicine.
Yep.
This stuff is important.
We're going to keep telling you.
Yep. So on the 8th of October, 1963, black singer-songwriter Sam Cooke and two members of his band were arrested for disturbing the peace in Shreveport, Louisiana, after being denied a room at a whites-only motel.
On the 10th, on the recommendation of FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover, the Hoove, nobody said that, U.S. Attorney General Robert Kennedy approved the placement of wiretaps in the home of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. and the offices of the Southern Baptist Leadership Conference.
Yeah, so, you know, I think a lot of times you look back on, you know, the civil rights era and the South winds up getting, I'm not going to say more than their fair share of the blame for, you know, the terrible state of things. And there was plenty of bad behavior down there. Don't get me wrong.
I was like, what are you doing right now?
But just, you know, the Kennedys were a New England dynasty, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, Bobby Kennedy, did not seem to have much of an issue with wiretapping the most prominent leader of the civil rights movement in 1963. So it's important to recognize and realize that this was not just a region of the country. This was not just a time and a place thing. This was, you know, it was pervasive. It was part of the fabric of the entire society.
And this is part of the reason why I wear a shirt that says all my heroes have FBI files.
Yeah.
Which used to seem pretty cool and rebellious.
Yeah.
Now it does not. It's weird. Yeah. I don't even want to wear that shirt right now.
Just to put a bow on this, on the 22nd of October, 159,000 of Chicago's approximately 470,000 public school students boycotted classes to protest segregationist school redistricting. So again, this is not a problem that was just affecting the South. This was in the Midwest. It was in the Northeast. It was everywhere.
Yeah.
So, yeah. All right, cool. Well, that wraps up putting into context where these issues are coming from. We are going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about what was in these issues this month. So stay tuned.
Hooray.
Welcome Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It is time to talk about all of these wonderful Marvel comics that were cover dated December 1963. A little bit later in the podcast, we're going to talk more about the Doctor Strange origin story in Strange Tales and the Spider-Man and Fantastic Four issues. But for right now, we're just going to do some quick hit treatments on the rest of the stuff that came out this month. So, Rob, you want to talk a little bit about the Sandman facing off against the Human Torch?
Yeah, Strange Tales number 115, The Sandman Strikes. This is written by Stan Lee with art by Dick Ayers, and it's pretty good art. So the Sandman has escaped from prison, and which, you know, he's made of sand, so they didn't hold him for very long.
No.
Reed Richards orders the Torch to find Spider-Man and ask him to recapture Sandman, which makes the Torch pretty upset. He's like, why can't I capture Sandman?
Yeah. I just love that Reed doesn't trust Johnny to actually do this job himself. He's like, go find the guy who beat him last time.
It's so good.
Yeah. So, you know, of course, Torch throws a temper tantrum because that's what he does. He makes a half-hearted effort to find Spidey, but he really resents not being asked to bring in Sandman himself.
Right. So here's what he decides to do, which is dress up like Spider-Man and lure Sandman out of hiding.
Yeah, and the way this is done, it's not obvious to the reader what he's doing. It's just you see what appears to be Spider-Man sitting on top of a building, and Sandman like slithers up the side of the building and hits him from behind. And even Sandman is a little perplexed by why Spider-Man didn't seem to see this coming.
Right, where his spider sense wasn't kicking in.
Yeah.
He makes a full hammer out of his hand and just wallops him in the back of the head.
I don't know how he didn't just collapse Johnny Storm's skull right there.
Yeah, but the two of them get into the big fight in the office building, and then eventually the sprinklers go off, which dampen both of their powers because wet sand, not as good as dry sand,
mm-hmm.
and wet Human Torch is not a torch.
Yeah. Right, right. They continue scrapping back and forth. Neither one of them really can lean on their powers all that much. Torch ultimately wins the fight because, and this is a quote, even with my flame all out, I still have enough excess heat in my body to more than double my normal strength. And he like literally punches Sandman in the chin and just knocks him out cold.
Yeah. It's, and he lifts him up above his head and twirls him around. It's like suddenly we have human non-torch Johnny has super strength.
Has super strength.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which was news to all of us. That's pretty much how he wraps this up. Spider-Man's kind of bummed because he sees that Johnny actually, Spider-Man's in the shadows and is just getting there to try to figure out what's happening. And he's bummed. Like Johnny actually took care of it himself. They have this sort of rivalry. So it's going on.
Yeah, and as Spidey says, I don't like the idea of him cutting in on my capers. Sooner or later, this town will be too small for the Torch and me.
I doubt it.
I think you both do okay.
Yeah, you're kind of overrating yourselves there.
Yeah, yeah.
You've got Giant Man in this town. Come on.
Talking about Giant Man, shall we switch over to Tales to Astonish number 50?
Yeah, I guess I accidentally segued us.
Yeah. So this is the story's called The Human Top. It's written by Stan Lee, who again wrote every issue of every comic this month, with art by Jack Kirby, inked by Steve Ditko, which is pretty sweet.
And if you thought that the Vanisher in X-Men number 2 was the world's lamest mutant, meet David Cannon, the Human Top.
Yeah. So what is the Human Top's powers? Well, he can spin forever very quickly. And this somehow is enough of a superpower that it makes him just the perfect adversary for Henry Pym, who is the world's lamest superhero. So right. It works out pretty well for him.
And David Cannon, after trying his hand at circus performing, professional wrestling, and rigging speed skating competition so he could win betting on himself, the Human Top becomes an infamous thief and public enemy number one somehow.
Yeah. And the fact that he is named public enemy number one is super hilarious once we get to the end of the Fantastic Four issue this month and you find out who they were fighting.
Yes. Because, man, I don't think the human top rates.
No, no, I would say not even close.
Yeah. And so Henry Pym might be Giant Man now, but he still has his network of ant informants.
Inform ants,
of course. So who alert him to the fact that the human top is planning on robbing Danley's department store.
Yeah. And Giant Man and Wasp learn about this via a device that Henry Pym has, which is called a thought wave communicator, which reads ants' thoughts and turns them into pictures. It's like an impressionistic comic book with no words, except it does spell out Danley's department
and the date and a clock. So there's a few words in there.
That's so crazy.
So ants are more sophisticated than you might think.
Yeah, according to Henry Pym.
The human top puts on his new supervillain costume because, you know, he's got a power, get a costume.
Yeah.
Which is among the best and worst things Jack Kirby ever designed. He actually spins on his head.
Yes.
So that's also the minute I saw that, I was like, whoa, wait, that's how he does it.
Yeah. Which it took me a second to realize that's what he's doing, but just to describe it. So his helmet is like this giant, like onion bulb looking thing.
Yeah.
The whole costume is green because, you know, of course villains dress in green in Marvel Comics. Mm-hmm. And so he's got like little slits for his eyes with this giant top head thing. But yeah, so he's like spinning around and he's grabbing things with his feet.
Yeah. Also totally convenient.
Yeah.
He robs the store with his feet, spinning on his head, despite Wasp and Giant Man trying to stop him.
Yeah, because he's not a great superhero, and she's really not into it. Like,
no.
She's just doing this because she wants to hang out with him.
Yeah, and I wish, I can't wait for, I don't know, 10 years or so when she becomes more fully fleshed out.
Yes.
But yeah, so Giant Man goes back to his lab and just whips up several devices to help him train to improve his speed so that he can beat the human top.
He like invents like a ball launcher and like a giant top that spins around, and he's like practicing trying to be fast enough to grab it.
And he has Wasp run the controls.
Yeah. But she's only turning it up halfway, and it's like he still can't do it.
And so he's in his giant form and he just bumbling around like an idiot.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's just, and so she didn't even have the heart to tell him that it was only at half speed, and he still couldn't. He caught it for a second.
Right.
I think.
Right. Yeah.
So then we stop the story midway because it's too big of a story to tell in one single issue.
Yeah. Yeah. If you want to find out if Giant Man and Wasp wind up defeating the human top, you got to tune in next month. True Believer. Is this the first cliffhanger that we've had?
I mean, this is arguably a cliffhanger, but yes.
In the most generous sense of the term.
It's not like we're even anywhere near a cliff. All it is like Giant Man can't catch his fake top machine at half speed. That's our cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and Kirby does try to like ramp up the dramatic tension in the very last panel where you see the human top running with just like a bundle of lit dynamite. It's like, what?
it's great stuff.
It's pretty good. Something that is slightly less ironically great is what Thor's up to this month in Journey into Mystery number 99. This is a story called The Mysterious Mr. Hyde. It's written by Stan Lee with art by Don Heck.
Mr. Hyde, I recall occasionally showing up throughout my years of reading Marvel comics,
yeah.
But I was like, oh yeah, he is a villain.
Yep.
This is another two-part story,
yep,
as well. And it's the first appearance of Mr. Hyde. That's the main notable fact about this story.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And Hyde is he's a guy named Calvin Zabo. And he basically invented like the real world version of the formula that Henry Jekyll created in Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde.
Yeah.
And this is definitely like, this whole character is straight out of Stan's brain. Stan was a sucker for all of the, like the classic adventure stories, you know, Treasure Island, Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde, Invisible mm-hmm. Man, you know, all that stuff. Like that was kind of his bread and butter. You know, he talked about The Thing being a reference to the Hunchback of Notre Dame. So like
the Hulk, obviously,
exactly.
Just Dr. Yep. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, yeah. Dr. Banner.
Yeah. Dr. Mr. Banner Hulk. And Mr. Hulk. Yeah. So yeah, definitely this is a Stan Lee creation, and you know, he doesn't try to reinvent the wheel here. I mean, he creates the Jekyll formula, he takes it, he turns into a Mr. Hyde character who calls himself Mr. Hyde.
It's pretty on the nose. And why did Calvin Zabo do this? Well, he did it in order to get revenge on lame Dr. Blake for literally the smallest possible slight. Blake refused to hire Zabo, who was planning to rob him, because Blake knew Zabo had been fired from every job he'd ever had.
Yeah, it's just like he's trying to run a scam on Blake. Zabo is, and like Blake sees through it immediately, and instead of just being like, okay, well, I guess I'll move on to the next sucker, like, this really sticks in Zabo's craw. He's like, I'm gonna fix his wagon.
And while Hyde is formulating his revenge plan, Thor is in Asgard still trying to convince Odin to let him marry Jane Foster, and Odin says that immortals can't marry mortals, so Thor suggests making Jane an immortal. Makes sense.
Yeah,
but Odin agrees to consider it if Jane can prove herself worthy. Yeah. Which is pretty interesting.
Which is also, like, as a dad, I'm pretty familiar with the whole concept of your kid really wants to do something and he won't stop asking for it, so you set an impossible condition state for him.
Yep.
Odin's been around, you know, he's been a dad for several thousand years longer than I have, so he knows how this works.
Yep. What's funny is that eventually, as we know as Marvel Comics readers, Jane Foster definitely proves herself worthy.
Oh, yes, like as worthy as you can be.
Yeah, so worthier in fact than Thor Odinson. Yep. Yeah,
it's gonna be about another 55 years before we get there, but yep. it's coming.
Grow old with us.
So anyway, Thor, he's up in Asgard, he heads back to Dr. Blake's office. As he's doing that, Hyde busts in and threatens Jane. During the skirmish, Thor decides it's a good idea if he turns back into Blake to go confront Hyde. During the fracas, he gets pushed out of a window.
this is great.
And yeah. Hyde's like, well, I guess my revenge is complete. And he just like tears a safe out of the wall. And
there,
like,
you go.
That's pretty much it.
And then we get to watch the lame doctor falling, but he's got his cane and he manages to hit it against a wall on his way down and turn into Thor. So sorry.
Yeah. So Thor flies back up to Blake's office. Hyde is already long gone by this point. He tells Jane that he rescued Blake, so everything's cool there. Apparently Jane tells someone about this because it's a radio broadcast, a big news update, saying that Thor rescued Don Blake from falling out of a window. Hyde hears this, he gets enraged, and he decides that now what he needs to do is he needs to destroy Thor.
That's upping the ante.
This is really escalating. Yeah. Like you literally did the thing you originally set out to do, which is steal all of Don Blake's stuff.
Yep. And you know, shoved him out a window.
Right. Yeah.
So we cut to the next day and we see Thor breaking into a bank and robbing it in broad daylight in front of dozens of witnesses. And now it's a citywide manhunt or God hunt for the mighty Thor to be continued next month.
Oh, another cliffhanger.
This is more of a hanging.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, you know, Hyde is a legit villain. First of all, he's not just a guy who spins in circles. He might be kind of a dummy. But I think I've mentioned this before in the podcast, like one of my entry points into Marvel Comics was, the Avengers stories of the mid to late 80s. And Hyde becomes a member of, a version of the Masters of Evil, and is just like, he was an absolutely horrific character in some of those stories. So I'm pretty interested to see how this continues.
And then we get the this fun Kirby piece in the back of all of these Journey into Mystery issues now. Tales of Asgard, Surtur, the Fire Demon.
Yeah. So this is another one of those. It's like the Marvel version of a Norse myth. Should probably mention that none of this actually tracks with actual Norse mythology, like nothing in this story does.
No.
But I mean, like, Surtur is he's a giant flaming demon who, like, really his point in Norse mythology is he shows up during Ragnarok, the Twilight of the Gods, with his flaming sword, and he destroys Asgard.
Yeah.
There's not really a lot else about him in the mythology.
just waiting for the end times.
Yeah, exactly. Kirby decides to riff on him, and I think it's great.
And in this story, he has a Odin facing searcher who has made an alliance with the rock trolls to rebel against Asgard. So Searcher lobs a chunk of Earth's molten core into space, which becomes the moon. I know that it says Stan wrote this, I still feel like Kirby's like, Stan, here's what's going to happen. Or he just handed the art to Stan and he's like, okay, I'll write some words here.
Yeah, yeah. What's also interesting, and I think this is the case with the previous ones that we've read, but I only noticed it with this one. There's no word balloons in these stories so far. Like, it's all captions. So Kirby, as the storyteller, is just laying everything out. And then, like, Stan's going through and captioning stuff.
Yeah, but, just blocked out. No, yeah. And there's no room to put a word balloon over this stuff. We've got some awesome things.
Yeah, they're like it's like 4 or 5 tiny splash pages per page. Yeah. It's great.
So Odin uses his power to cause Earth to spin on its axis, trapping Surtur in the center of the planet with centrifugal force.
What they're doing is they're taking Surtur and they're making him into like a very traditional, like, Judeo-Christian devil figure. Yeah. Like, he lives in hell in the center of the earth.
He is a horned flame monster that lives in the center of the earth.
Yep.
So, yep. So makes sense. Story checks out.
All right. So we got one more to touch on real quickly. This is Tales of Suspense number 48. The New Iron Man Battles the Mysterious Mr. Dahl, written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko with Dick Ayers. So this is the debut of a new version of the Iron Man armor. Just kind of a little backstory on this. So anecdotally, like, Stan Lee, he always hated the original Iron Man design.
Yeah.
Like, we've talked about this before. He had the color changed from, like, battleship steel gray to gold in Iron Man's second appearance. In the first issue of the Avengers, the Wasp calls out Iron Man's armor as hideous. Basically, like, you know, Kirby and Don Heck they took their wax at it, and Stan apparently wasn't thrilled with the results. So now it's time for Steve Ditko to take a crack at it. And so what he comes up with is basically the first version of the slimmed down red and gold armor that the character has been identified with ever since. And there's a lot of thought that went into this. There's literally, like, in the issue, a 3-page spread of Tony Stark trying on the armor piece by piece for the first time and demonstrating all of its features. So Ditko went, like, above and beyond the call. Like,
right.
To an unsurprising, because it's Steve Ditko, he went to an obsessive level of detail about this.
Yeah. And it's and for people who are familiar with the movies and the sort of how it sort of builds itself.
Yeah.
You know, like, hits a button and it just sort of builds itself and stretches itself. This is where that comes from.
Yeah.
This is like, he puts on a bracelet and then the arm magnetizes up to the shoulder piece.
Yes.
That's in the torso that's still hosting his, like, heart saving, you know, reactor or whatever
right.
It is.
Yep.
But all of the pieces or transistor, I forget.
Like, we've seen Iron Man pulling his previous armor out of a briefcase and, like, trying to make the case as, like, no, it collapses. Totally. But it's like, that armor never looked like it was, you know, this armor does look like it can totally.
Yeah. That armor didn't look like it would fit in a bathtub, let alone under his suit or anything else.
Right. Know? Exactly. Yeah. So this is, it's much more streamlined and, it's just a cool design. I love, like, this, like, the early Iron Man armors. This is one of my favorite versions.
And with the little horned piece on, you know, there's, I
like
mean,
the little
not
widow's peak.
Yeah, the widow's peak on the mask, which is classic, and it comes back every once in a while mm-hmm. as a retro reference throughout the years.
Yes,
and so all that is to say, the rest of the issue is almost an afterthought.
Yeah, this issue is seriously just about getting Iron Man in a new suit of clothes.
It does bring us the wonderful, fabulous Mr. Dahl. He's not even a doctor, and guess what? He's basically the puppet master.
Yeah.
Yeah. He has a doll that he molds really fast, and once it looks like you, he can control you.
Or he can cause you pain.
Oh, he can cause you pain. It's more of a voodoo doll kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. And this is so, originally Mr. Dahl was going to be named Mr. Payne, but the Comics Code Authority apparently was like, nope, you can't call him Mr. Payne. So
that's the second their runner up was like, we'll go from Payne to Dahl.
Yeah.
That will definitely get by.
Exactly.
Maybe they were up against the deadline, which they were.
The issue might have been done and they might have needed to have like a different four letter word.
Yeah.
Like to fit with the, like to quickly go back through and replace everything in the word balloon. So,
oh man.
Yeah.
He's wearing what? Blue pants.
Yeah.
Green shirt. Pretty much normal, just baggy pants and a green shirt.
Yeah.
And then this sort of hood that has a couple of downward facing horns from the sides of his head.
Yeah.
It's blue.
Yeah. It's very strange.
It's not a terrifying costume by any means.
Ditko put 98% of his effort into designing Iron Man's new armor, and with a remaining 2%,
yes,
came up with Mr. Doll. It's like, I don't know, shirt, pants, weird hood.
Done. I'll put shoes on him. So Mr. Doll is using his power to convince millionaires to sign over their fortunes to him. So he causes them pain until they obey and sign over their fortunes. Iron Man tries to stop him, but his old armor is too slow and heavy, so the upgrade.
And then they come up with this plan to lure Mr. Doll into a trap. Unfortunately, it involves Pepper Potts being played for a fool. I wasn't wild about this part of the story at all. Tony Stark is put under police protection because they're like, you're the next millionaire who's going to be targeted by Mr. Doll. We're going to lock you in this like secluded room. And he says, I got to have Pepper with me because I want to be alone with her so I can invite her. I can ask her out on a date. And Pepper's over the moon. This is what she has been waiting for.
Right.
It's like, this is
why she's employed there.
That's why she's still working for Tony Stark, is because she wants to be Mrs. Tony Stark.
Yeah.
So she thinks my chance has come at last, and she's all over him. And he's like, yeah, great. Like, make it look realistic. And then he like ditches her and like escapes through a secret door.
Yeah. So one, just sad for her. Two, sad for the agency of all women's rights.
Yes.
and true, you know, equality.
Yeah.
But if we're just rolling with this 60s feel, she's really heartbroken. She thinks that this is really going to happen. He's like, I brought you in because you're such a great actress. Keep that sobbing up.
Yeah,
you know, like,
yeah.
And he also knows that she will cover for him.
Right.
Which is also sad. So he slips away and calls Iron Man for help. Of course, then the all new Iron Man, he uses a transistor from across the room to remold the doll right as Mr. Doll is going to drop it.
Right.
And when it falls, he's the one who takes the pain. So.
Right. And he's led away by the police. And so, yep, the story wraps up. No cliffhanger here.
No.
Mr. Doll kind of reappears later on, but not as Mr. Doll.
Yeah. And I think the new armor may be what gets Stan more interested in,
yeah,
in writing Iron Man from here.
He's totally.
It's not just the bathtub full of armor, which is what I'm going to call the old Iron Man.
Yeah, well, and I mean, you know, so first of all, Stan only recently started taking over writing Iron Man at this point, but I really don't think it's a coincidence that now that the character has a design that obviously sticks, and Stan, you would assume, is a lot happier with this, all of a sudden, like in literally in the next month or two, Iron Man starts getting good villains and more interesting stories. And for the first time, the character really starts to take off.
So it was worth it to have Ditko spend the time on the armor, not so much on Mr. Doll.
Yes.
Yeah.
All right. So that was our, well, maybe not so quick roundup of kind of these secondary stories from this month. We're going to take another break. When we come back, we're going to tell you a little bit about the origin of Doctor Strange. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. Time to talk a little bit about the origin of Doctor Strange. This comes as the backup story in Strange Tales number 115, written by Stan Lee with art by Steve Ditko. So after three Doctor Strange stories, we are finally getting his origin in a super long, I believe it's advertised as a double-sized 8-page story. This is not quite Spider-Man quality, but I think Steve Ditko really knows how to tell a compelling origin story, and he fits it into just 8 pages, which is pretty impressive. And one of the things that proves how strong it is that when they got around to doing the Doctor Strange movie, the origin is pretty much exactly what, yeah, you see on the page.
Similar to Iron Man's origin. It's, yeah, like, it's pretty much shot by shot. It's funny that the the editor's note on the start of that story is like this long note from Stan basically saying, your flood of letters let us know that we sort of forgot to tell you the origin.
And, right.
And it's pretty hilarious. The humility that they put into those things is super funny and self-deprecating humor.
Yes. Yep.
Humility might be overstating, but self-deprecating is definitely there. So in the story, Dr. Stephen Strange arrives in India and seeks out the Ancient One, who has been referred to as the Master thus far, to heal him. The Ancient One looks into Strange's memories to determine whether or not he is worthy of being healed. Strange was an excellent surgeon, but a pretty terrible human being. He's always like, how much money am I going to get paid for this surgery?
He literally, like three panels in a row, we see different scenarios. It's very much like a morality play, where it's like, will you do this charitable thing, this good thing? No, because I'm not being paid. It's like very, very archetypal.
And so after a car accident ruined the nerves in his hands, he is no longer able to perform surgery and his life falls apart. So he hears rumors of the Ancient One's ability to cure anyone and it seeks him out.
Yeah. So back in the present day, the Ancient One says that now that he understands where Strange is coming from, he can't help Strange because his motivations are so selfish. But he does offer, if Strange stays with him and studies with him, Strange might be able to learn how to become a decent human being and heal himself. And Strange is just like, yeah, of course, not having it. He accuses the Ancient One of being a fraud. He tries to leave, but then a blizzard whips up out of nowhere and prevents him from leaving.
And so after being led to his chamber where he's going to hang out now, Strange witnesses the Ancient One being attacked by black magic. The Ancient One survives, but he is old and weak and needs to find a successor. Strange overhears the Ancient One's student, Mordo. Maybe you remember Mordo, praying to Dormammu for the power to destroy the Ancient One.
Yeah, I think this might be the first time Dormammu has been mentioned, which is one of my favorite Steve Ditko creations.
Yeah,
I think he shows up soon.
Yeah. And again, you would know him from the movies.
Yes, that's right. He's the final boss.
Yeah.
Mordo catches Strange spying on him, and he silences him with black magic that prevents him from warning the Ancient One about what he's up to. Mm-hmm. So since Strange can't tell the Ancient One what Mordo's doing, he instead opts to agree to stay at the temple and learn from the Ancient One in the hopes that eventually he'll figure out a way to protect him. And having done this altruistic thing, the Ancient One accepts Strange's offer and, with a wave of his hand, just removes Mordo's curse.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, too, in this case, Ditko previously in Doctor Strange stories didn't... they just sort of look at each other when they're fighting, or there's like astral versions of them fighting.
Right.
This time when the spell is cast for Strange, he's got a like metal riveted mask across his mouth. Yeah. So he feels this mask and then like lightning bolts that are binding him.
Yes.
But they're not really there, but that's so they show a like physical manifestation of how he perceives this spell, this black magic, which is new.
It's a little more illustrative.
Yeah. It plays better in drawings.
Totally. Yeah. It's not just two guys staring at each other.
Yeah.
But so the Ancient One just gets rid of all of that because he saw right through Mordo's spells. The student can't do anything the master can't figure out. He's aware that Mordo is evil, but he's choosing to keep him close because he thinks that's the safer move. And then Dr. Strange begins his years-long mystical training with the Ancient One, and that leads him to becoming the character who we have seen already. So that's the origin of Dr. Strange. Pretty good for just having 8 pages to work with. Ditko knows how to use that 9-panel grid. I mean, there's a few times where he expands a panel or two, but he fits a ton of story into a very small space. Let's take a quick break. And when we come back, let's talk about Amazing Spider-Man number 7, because that's another book that Ditko illustrated. And I think there are parts of this story where he uses that grid to better effect than I think has ever been done. And I don't want to oversell it, but I really love this issue.
Yeah, there's action that's perfectly demonstrated, like storyboards.
Yes, absolutely. So let's take a quick break. When we come back, Amazing Spidey number 7. All right, welcome back to Marvel by the Month. It's time to talk about the return of the Vulture in Spider-Man number 7, written by Stan Lee, art by Steve Ditko.
After getting a recap of the first battle between Spider-Man and the Vulture, we see that the Vulture, a model prisoner, is working in the prison machine shop. But of course, he hasn't really reformed.
No.
He's using parts from the shop to rebuild his wings, and he escapes. So Spider-Man tracks him down and plans to use the same anti-magnetic inverter that he defeated him with last time. But the Vulture just plays possum and surprises Spidey with a counterattack. He upgraded his wings so that the anti-magnetic inverter no longer works against them. They switch polarity or something cool. Spidey crashes hard onto a rooftop and Vulture thinks he killed him.
Yeah, he doesn't say killed because no one, that's a word that never appears in Marvel Comics, I've noticed, but he says something like, I finished him off.
Yeah.
Or, you know, that's the end of him or something like that.
Yeah, and there's some of that in FF too when we get there. But so it turns out that Spidey's spider strength and agility saved his life, and he just winds up with a severely sprained arm. But it's one of the tropes of Spider-Man. Like, he's hurt or he gets just beaten to a pulp.
Yes.
Like, Spider-Man gets beat up more than anybody. Like, Daredevil even.
Yeah.
His costume's always ripped up. He's like got a sling or a cold.
He's like Bruce Willis in every Bruce Willis movie.
Yeah.
Yeah. So things didn't go great for Spidey, you know, with the first outing with the Vulture, which is, again, kind of a Spider-Man trope.
It's
pretty typical that the villain gets the best of Spidey and then he has to figure out a way to come back from it. In round two, Spidey and Vulture wind up having what I thought was a pretty legitimately funny and also thrilling battle through the offices of the Daily Bugle.
So
the way this all comes about is, while Peter Parker's getting his arm checked out, the Vulture decides that his next target is going to be J. Jonah Jameson. He's going to steal the Daily Bugle's payroll. And of course, when the Vulture arrives to try to rob Jameson, Peter Parker is also there trying to sell some photos. So you know what's coming next.
Jonah risks his life trying to convince the Vulture not to rob him and maybe settle for publicity instead.
Yeah.
Total Jonah move.
I love this so much. Like, he's super cheap, but he's not a coward. Like, he spends several panels trying to argue with the Vulture. It's like, you don't want to rob me. It's like, how would I give you publicity instead? I'll be ruined if you rob
right,
me. It's like Vulture's like quickly losing his patience.
But then the fight starts rolling through and it's full of action. This is what I think you were referring to when we're talking about this grid.
Yeah.
It's the 6-panel grid, but the action just goes everywhere through the building.
Yeah. The Vulture is trying to get away from Spider-Man. Spider-Man's chasing the Vulture, and Jameson is chasing Spider-Man, telling them to stop because they're trashing his offices.
So good. And there's all kinds of cool little moves. Like, Vulture's basically getting down to the press room to where he can actually have some room. But everything about it is just cool step-by-step action. You can follow the flow. It's like these could be storyboards.
Yeah, totally. And as we mentioned earlier, everything inside of the office when this fight starts is a 6-panel grid. It's 3 rows of 2 panels each. It's like boom, 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 boom. Like you said, storyboarding it all out.
Mm-hmm.
The fight inside the office ends when Vulture he escapes out of a window. And then Ditko shifts to a different kind of 6-panel grid, where it's now 2 rows of 3 panels and it's much more vertical.
Yeah, and which is perfect for this flying.
Perfect, because Vulture is like taking off into the sky he grabs Spider-Man and he's like hauling him up into the clouds.
Yeah. And so now each panel has more headroom, which
right.
is great. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like a really clever technical little thing. Vulture, he thinks he's got Spidey, you know, like nailed this time. It's like, well, yeah, basically it's like, I didn't drop you from high enough the last time, but you know, now, you know, I've got you. This is definitely the end of Spider-Man. And Spidey surprises him by webbing up his wings. So the two of them now are joined together and they're just plummeting to Earth.
Yeah. It's an, It's an awesome solution. It's like, I'm not locked in here with you. Yeah. You're locked in here with me.
Exactly. And he scares the hell out of the vulture. Like, the vulture is convinced they're going to crash and die.
Yeah. And he just becomes basically a pleading, whiny old man.
It's so satisfying.
Yeah. It's great. And then, Spider-Man makes a web parachute.
Yep.
And sort of rides the vulture like a little horsey as they plummet to the ground. And he just ties him up and is like, hello, police, come get this guy.
Yep.
Awesome.
He just lets the vulture drift to the ground. He hops off and jumps onto the side of a building and just watches the vulture, you know, drift downward. And then he hears Jameson calling out to him. And so Spidey, like, he heads over there. He's expecting a thank you. He absolutely should know better, because Jameson just tells him that he holds Spider-Man responsible for all the damage that they did to the Daily Bugle. And Spidey's just like, you know what, forget you. And he just like webs up his face.
Yep.
Yeah. And it's just, it's the perfect, you know, like the one person who's ever been able to just shut Jameson up.
Yep.
Yeah.
This plants a couple of cool story seeds. So the tensions escalate between Peter Parker and Flash Thompson.
Yeah, this happens in a couple different points in this story.
And Flash has always been Peter's antagonist at Midtown High, but there are several points in the story where Peter almost takes a swing at him. Like the bullying is taking a toll, but he's like, I can literally kill this guy.
Yeah.
And I don't know if he says kill. But
he makes reference to someone's going to lose a mouthful of teeth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you get this idea about the darkness inside of Peter Parker's mind from being bullied, you know, nerd that he was.
Right.
Or is, to all appearances, for Flash or other people at school. And then the romance continues to bloom between Peter and Betty Brant. So that's Jonah's secretary.
Yeah.
They're flirty at a couple of points in the story, and it even ends with Peter inviting Betty to rest your head on my shoulder, blue eyes, and let's enjoy the silence.
Yeah. And the silence he's referring to is Jonah's face being webbed up.
Although it's not exactly silence, because you see that there's like a, you know, razzle frazzin with stars and exclamations and things. Yeah.
It's great. Really good action in the story. Some really good Peter Parker moments in the story. And it's just, you know, like Ditko putting on a masterclass for comic book storytelling.
It's solid. Now that we're talking about it too, sometimes his stuff just looks sort of frenetic and paranoid and gets that emotional feel, but this is like just solid action. Usually that's Kirby's domain.
Right.
And I think he's stepping up.
Well, great. We got one issue left to go. Before we do that, let's take another quick break. And then we will take a look at the Fantastic Four versus the Hatemonger. Welcome back to Marvel by the Month. We've got one more issue to discuss. It's Fantastic Four number 21, The Hatemonger, written by Stan Lee, with art by Jack Kirby, inked by George Bell. And so we have talked a lot about how Marvel Comics at the time has tried to incorporate real-world topics. It's one of Stan and Jack's first attempts to address what we would now call white supremacy.
Yeah.
It is rough and it's clumsy. It is not subtle, but it's super well-intentioned. So I think it's important to kind of view it through that lens. The villain on the cover of the issue is the Hatemonger, who's basically wearing a purple Klan robe. Of course, the Klan was a very visible presence in the South during civil rights. And, you know, obviously before that, and it wasn't strictly limited to the South, but, you know, that's where, you know, it first arose from, and, you know, where it had a very visible presence, you know, as the civil rights era was taking place. Anyone who saw this on the newsstands, there'd be no mistaking what this guy was.
Like, yeah. What he represents.
Yeah. Yeah.
Is the Klan.
Yes.
And white supremacy.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, no doubt. And it's obviously also a white person inside when he's got white hands.
Yeah.
You know, so he's Caucasian.
Yeah.
So This story gets in with the hate monger has been holding rallies in town, stirring up anti-immigrant sentiment.
Yeah.
So that this really struck a chord to me. I mean, even as ham-handed as it might be, as obvious as it might be, it was in the current climate. It meant something to me.
Well, and I mean, some of these quotes, you could be hearing this in the news these days. Those who are not with us are against us. They must be destroyed. We must drive all the foreigners back where they came from. We must show no mercy to those who we hate.
This rhetoric is obviously, it's like a playbook.
Yeah.
And that kind of rhetoric is something that I always, in my more scholarly ways, associate with like Plato's Republic. Like Socrates is saying, here's how you create a model society, but model is in quotes. And it's right. about, you know, exclusion and elitism and any number of other things, building what is essentially any working republic that we see now. And I feel like, you know, maybe that I would give credit to most leaders as saying they're reading that and then doing when they're doing something bad to mm-hmm. create this thing. Mm-hmm. But I think maybe our current leadership just read this comic. Just yeah. It was yeah. like the Cliff's Notes. For
yeah, well, they weren't clear on who the villain of the piece was.
yeah, it just seems strong. Yeah. Such a strong character.
Such a strong guy. He has a really clear idea what he wants and how he's going to get it.
And he's going to, you know, get people to hate foreigners.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I found that it's interesting that the hate monger's rhetoric is not explicitly racial.
Yeah.
I think some of that might be due to the comics code because it didn't always draw a line between illustrative uses of racist rhetoric versus like actual racist rhetoric. You know,
right, right.
If that makes sense.
Yeah.
But I also think it's possible that having the hate monger speaking out against foreigners specifically,
yeah,
I think made him a completely unsympathetic character to the readers of the era. Because, you know, this is definitely a time when, you know, America was taking pride in being a melting pot,
mm-hmm.
Especially in a place like New York. In the middle of the 20th century, you know, Americans still would describe themselves as being, you know, it's like, well, I'm a quarter Scottish and I'm a quarter Irish.
Irish American. I'm an Italian American.
Right.
I'm
a... Yeah. When mainstream white American culture was no more than a couple generations removed from
Ellis Island.
From Ellis Island. You yeah. know? Yeah. Yeah. So
again, New York. So
yeah. And I think if you were talking strictly in terms of like race or color or something like that, I don't know if it would have played as well to the audience of the time, because unfortunately, even people who might consider themselves fairly tolerant or open-minded might still be like, well, as long as my daughter's not dating one of them, you know,
right.
like that kind of thing.
Yeah. So. Which is kind of, unfortunately, you know, they're not going to touch racism per se.
Mm.
But, you know, getting to back to the story itself. Ben is upset that the hate monger is drawing crowds, but Reed reassures him that, quote, I know how you feel, Ben, but his type usually doesn't get very far in a free nation like ours.
Oh, Reed. You innocent boy.
So the FF takes a walk, intervenes at a rally that has like the brown shirts as green shirts here with yeah, their exact yeah. hats and uniforms yeah. and torches.
Keep in mind, this is being written and illustrated by a couple of Jewish Americans, both of whom served in World War II, one of whom actually liberated a concentration camp.
Yeah.
So Jack Kirby's not playing around.
Yeah. And I'm fine with a lack of subtlety here. There's a guy called the hate monger. They're going to beat him up.
Yep.
And I'm very happy about that.
Yeah, yeah. I always look at Ben Grimm as being the stand-in for Jack Kirby and Reed Richards as being the stand-in for Stan.
Yeah.
So the conversation they're having, like Stan's like, don't worry about it, Jack. It's like, this guy's an idiot, but he's not going to go too far. And Ben's like, I just want to punch him.
Yeah.
I want to punch him until he's done.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So the FF intervenes in this rally. They're protecting the immigrant citizens. The hate monger hits them with his H ray, which I assume means hate, which causes them to turn on each other with unreasonable hatred. So, which is kind of an interesting new trait for a villain, because we have a lot of rehashed things that happen already in this universe. So having people just hate each other is crazy. It's not actual racism. It's a ray gun.
Right.
Yeah.
Which also softens the whole idea of like, well, this isn't Americans behaving like this because Americans are harboring xenophobia in their hearts.
Right.
They've been hypnotized by this supervillain's gun.
So the FF end up splitting up and Reed returns to the Baxter building where he runs into his old army buddy, Nick Fury, everybody.
Hey, there you go. A little connection to the 1940s Marvel Universe.
Yeah. And it turns out Nick's been working with the CIA and he's a colonel now or something. But he tells Reed about the South American nation of San Gusto.
Which I believe that literally translates into good taste.
Or just taste. Yeah. where he's been stationed. So Nick's been down there with the CIA.
Yeah.
The US has been supporting democratic efforts to the tune of millions of dollars there, but a revolution has erupted overnight that threatens the balance of power.
Yeah, and this is a revolution that came out of nowhere.
Right.
So Fury knows that something's up and he's basically put together that the hate monger has something to do with this.
Yeah, and he's come to get Reed. He's come to get the FF.
Yeah.
But the FF hates each other right now because they got hit with the H ray.
Right.
So everybody's off on their own. They've all said terrible things. One might say hateful. So Reed says that he'll head down alone to check it out because he doesn't need the rest of the FF.
Right. After Reed takes off, Fury realizes that the hate monger's already gotten to the FF. He knows what's going on here. So the other three members show up at the Baxter building. Fury uses reverse psychology on them to trick them into wanting to go to San Gusto as well, because he's no dummy.
And he knows how to motivate people into action.
Exactly. So they head to San Gusto in their ICBM rocket, which you have seen in several cutaway diagrams of the Baxter building.
Yep.
They actually use the damn thing. So hate monger has seen both Reed take off in the pogo plane and the rest of them take off in the ICBM. So he heads to San Gusto as well.
And in San Gusto, Reed repels a rebel assault single-handedly and finds hate monger's underground lair. And there's all kinds of, there's some funny gags, like Reed lays himself down flat and acts like he's a road. So the rebels are like, I don't remember this path or road being
this
here.
Bright blue path.
Yeah, let's walk on it. And then he wraps them all up and is like, ha ha.
It's
win.
A very Plastic Man move.
Yeah, total Plastic Man. And also for them to run on the new blue road.
Right.
Yeah. So, but when he finds the underground lair of the hate monger, he is taken captive with some nerve gas that freezes him up.
Mm-hmm.
But Fury shows up, guns a-blazing. Classic Fury.
And
I think he even wahoos. Yeah.
As he runs in. Yeah. It's the Howling Commandos thing.
He's got his signature. So Fury forces hate monger to give Reed the antidote to the H ray. Hate monger escapes, but Reed grabs more doses of the antidote and tricks the rest of the FF into taking them. And the band is back together again.
Yep. So as Reed is freeing his teammates' brains from the H-ray, Fury continues fighting through the hate monger's base. And the now non-hypnotized FF shows up to support him. Hate monger tries to blast them with the H-ray once again, but Sue knocks his aim off while she's invisible. He accidentally hits his own men, who wind up shooting him dead. So that's the end of the hate monger. So now the only thing left is to figure out who this guy was. Reed and Fury unmask him, and he turns out to be Adolf Hitler.
So when we're saying it is not subtle, it is not subtle.
It is the least subtle thing.
The hate monger is Hitler.
Is Hitler.
Yeah.
You get it? Do you get it? These guys who are talking hate, they're Hitlers.
Yeah.
Like, it's... I know, like, you know, Stan and Jack had a very collaborative working routine, but this just smacks. This feels like a Jack Kirby.
Jack's
story.
Like, Stan, come on.
It's like, Stan,
you know, this guy,
Stan,
is.
He's Hitler.
Yeah.
I'm going to tell a story about the Fantastic Four beating up Hitler, who's also a Klansman.
Yeah.
That's and we're going to bring address.
Nick Fury into this thing, too. Yes.
Yeah. Like, I just love Jack Kirby's very clear sense of right and wrong.
Right.
Like,
there is no gray area.
No, not at all. And Reed, Stan. Tries to soften it a little bit. He says, or it's possibly one of the many doubles the Führer was reported to have.
Yeah.
That's what Reed says.
So maybe it's not the original Hitler. Right. That Hitler actually died already.
Right, right. Yeah. But he's a Hitler.
Yeah.
Yeah.
This is just an ex or a Hitler impersonator that's just as bad as Hitler.
Right, exactly. But yeah, so So the menace of the hate monger has come to an end. But on the way home, Reed cautions his team and, of course, the reader by saying that until men truly love each other, regardless of race, creed, or color, the hate monger will still be undefeated. Let's never forget that.
And they say race, you know, which I think is great. Yep. Like, this is obviously not, if it wasn't obvious, it was a political stance.
Sure.
This helps drive it home. And after that, it says, and Reed Richards' words never shall be forgotten, not while the stars and stripes still wave, not while America endures. There is an anthemic music going on behind here.
Yep.
God bless America. Let's all be, get along and not hate each other.
Yes.
It's great. It's I honestly was like, did not care about the lack of subtlety. I was on board for this ride. Loved this comic book.
Well, you know, and it's, this is not the first time I've read this book, but it's the first time in many years that I've read this book. In this day and age, I actually liked the clear, unambiguous, this is wrong.
Yeah, I think that's I think how I was reading it is like, this message needs to be shared with everyone again right now, because somehow they have forgotten.
It has become fashionable in certain circles to talk about how I don't want politics in my comics these days. Politics have always been a part of comics. Like, stories like this have always been a part of comics. The first issue of Captain America has him punching Hitler in the face. Like, what you are saying when you say something like that is, this comic is not reflecting my personal politics. And if that's the case, maybe the problem is not with the comic, but maybe it's with your just awful, awful views on the world. All right. I got to take a break after that. Then we'll come back and wrap this whole thing up.
Yep. Panel of the month.
All right.
Panel of the month.
All right. Welcome back. All we got left to do is talk about our panels of the month. I'll go first.
Yeah.
If you'd like.
Yeah.
So mine comes from Amazing Spider-Man number 7, page 13, panel 4. So this comes right before the big extended fight scene between the Vulture and Spider-Man in the Daily Bugle offices. And I just love this scene. So this is when the Vulture has shown up. He's demanded all of Jonah's payroll for the Daily Bugle. This is like the fourth panel in a row where Jonah is trying to stonewall him. So the Vulture is like quickly losing his cool. Jonah is, he's pleading with his hands upturned, but he's not groveling. And Peter is like quietly slipping out the door in the background to turn into Spider-Man. And just the back and forth is great. Jonah's saying, look, maybe we can make a deal. I could give you publicity. And the Vulture's like, all I want is money, mister. Like, your money.
I'm a supervillain standing here. I don't care about that. I get free publicity.
Yeah, exactly. You have given me publicity. It's like, you printed my photo so many times. Yeah. And I just loved like all the tension being held in this panel.
Yeah. And it's also dialogue tension. It's not action. And the action's about to break.
Yes. Yeah.
Yes. So it's great. Yep. Yeah. There's so many good things in that comic. I had a number of panels from that comic.
Oh, and then, yeah, yeah.
But I got so many tingles from the FF. So I had to, Fantastic Four, number 21, page 4, panel 4. This is, you already quoted the hate monger's line, and it's the hate monger with like fires from the torches of the green shirts that are surrounding him at this rally. And he's saying, we must drive all the foreigners back where they came from. We must show no mercy to those we hate. But off panel, it's either Sue or Ben. It's too eloquent to be Johnny. it says, Reed, it's unbelievable. He seems to have the crowd in a trance. They're actually agreeing with his un-American sentiments. And to me, this all just smacked of everything I see on the news all the time.
Yeah.
Even, you know, generationally with people I've had disagreements with, this is something that we've said and politically even in the past who we've disagreed with, they're like, this is just un-American.
Right.
So it was nice to see it here in one way, but also not nice that this is whatever, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
And that should be put to rest by now.
Yeah. Yeah. This is a really good panel. It's a really powerful panel. It's a totally unsubtle panel, and that's totally fine.
That's what we were saying.
Yeah. You're right. It's really nice to hear someone use the term un-American and having it be used, you know, on the side of the good guys.
Yeah.
If you're not committed to the whole idea of, you know, all people being created equal, and then what are you doing here? That's what we do here.
Right.
Yeah.
And it's this is like a year and a half into Fantastic Four.
Yeah.
The universe maybe getting close on two, but it's the universe has only existed for 2 years.
Yeah.
And we're here.
Yep.
And again, it's black and white. It's not gray.
Yeah.
But it's in one panel we see both of those things. And
yeah.
And with this, you know, purple hooded Klansman guy with torches in front of him, it's so evocative of the news now. So I was just like, thank goodness that these guys did this and they instilled these virtues in the heroes that we admire. Even though we talk about all the problematic things in this time and universe, and even with the heroes, it's good to see that.
Yeah.
So thanks, Jack.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's built into the DNA of the characters. If this is not a sentiment that you can totally get behind, now read something else.
Yep.
All right. Well, cool. That's it for this week of Marvel by the Month. We have made it to the end of 1963.
Woohoo!
So we'll be kicking off next week with January 1964. Between now and next week, you can hit us up online. Go to marvelbythemonth.com. You should definitely be following us on Instagram at marvelbythemonth. And drop us an email, marvelbythemonth@gmail.com. If you want to drop a voice recording into an email and send it to us, that is a thing that we could pop onto the podcast at some point. Or, you know, if you don't feel like talking into it, just shoot us a line and we might wind up using it. We'd love to hear from you.
Yeah. And keep listening. We have a lot of guests coming up.
Yes.
There's going to be some. I am really excited about talking to some of these people. We're finally getting in some more creators. Not that our friends aren't awesome and amazingly geeky and hilarious, but getting in some more perspectives, which is what we've always hoped for with this.
Yes. And I think the most important quality that our friends have had is patience.
Before and after this podcast. Yeah. During.
Yeah. As we try to work through, audio hardware issues and things like that. We're really grateful to everyone who's been along for the ride so far. And that includes every single one of you. So thank you so much. Until next week. I'm Brian Stratton.
And I am Rob Milne.
And we will see you next week for next month.
Nice.
Yay.